Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for the vacationing Jim Garrity today. We've got good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives and, quite frankly, hopefully for just about everyone as we look at these three issues, two of which relate to yesterday's bad martini, the story that has rightfully dominated and horrified the nation, the murder of nine people at the Brother Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina on Wednesday night. Just as we were doing the podcast on Thursday, the suspected gunman was taken into custody, and reports are now coming out that he has already confessed to the killings. We'll look at this in two different ways. The good news, if there's any good news out of this, and any major tragedy that we see as communities, as states, or as a nation as a whole, Ian, is how people rally in a time of crisis and tragedy. We obviously saw it on a grand scale on 9/11 and in the days and weeks afterwards, and we saw it at Sandy Hook and Virginia Tech and some of these other horrible events that have happened over the past several years. Nikki Haley is the governor of South Carolina. This was her emotional statement in her first press avail following the news of the killing.
We woke up today, and the heart and soul of South Carolina was broken. And so we have some grieving too. And we've got some pain we have to go through. Parents are having to explain to their kids how they can go to church and feel safe. Having said that, we are a strong and faithful state. We love our state, we love our country, and most importantly, we love each other.
Not one word about politics in there, as it should be. And here's Pastor Rashawn Wilson, who's pastor of the Impact Church in Charleston, speaking at a gathering outside of another AME church in Charleston.
I just encourage you that where there is unity, there is strength. And where there's strength, there is hope. So before this day is over, introduce yourself to somebody. You know, get somebody's number, create a relationship with them so that we can come together in common unity as a community.
Ian, even in Washington, bipartisan members of Congress going outside the Capitol for some time of prayer on Thursday. So we really did, at every level, see a lot of what's very right about America in one of its darkest hours.
Yeah, absolutely. The moral question of this, the narrative of it is very simple. You had a hateful, racist individual who committed a gravely evil act. And I think it's clear to everyone that's what happened. Journalists like myself have the dark duty sometimes of spending our days on Twitter, and we've seen, you know, a person here and there, a media person, say, well, why aren't conservatives willing to call this racist? It's just nonsense. Everyone has been willing not only to identify the motive, but the horror of this. And the fact is that the response has, as you said, struck the right tone from many elected leaders, certainly from community leaders in Charleston, and a great deal of the media. And so that is encouraging.
There are, of course, others, as you mentioned, if you pay enough attention to Twitter, who are going to stir the political pot. And President Obama went to the podium at the White House briefing room yesterday, talked about, obviously, the pain and the healing that needs to happen in this community. But he also had this to say about the gun issue.
We don't have all the facts, but we do know that, once again, innocent people were killed in part because someone who wanted to inflict harm had no trouble getting their hands on a gun. Let's be clear. At some point, we as a country will have to reckon with the fact that this type of mass violence does not happen in other advanced countries. It doesn't happen in other places with this kind of frequency. And it is in our power to do something about it.
And as you probably heard yesterday, Ian, in his kind of exasperated resignation, the president admitted nothing in terms of a gun control agenda is going to get through this Congress. So the president, in addition to the timing of this so soon after the actual event, but as you and others looked into this, his agenda wouldn't have actually accomplished anything in this case.
Yeah, that's right. So my colleague Charles Cook wrote about this on the corner at National Review yesterday, and I'll crib from him. There are two things. One is, so the original story was that his father had given him the gun as a 21st birthday present. First of all, that fits into the Toomey Mansion gun control scheme that was being debated not too long ago, and the left was adamant that this would not apply to private exchange of firearms. But the thing is, because the shooter here was already awaiting trial for a felony charge, he was not allowed legally to have a firearm for any reason, you know, private gift or not. So he certainly broke the law in that regard. Now the story is that he may have purchased the gun, which means that he went through a background check and was deemed eligible. So the left keeps saying that we need, you know, all of these background checks. Well, if he did go through a background check and was deemed eligible, then the question is, why didn't the background check work? The third thing is that if you look at the president's proposals on gun control, none of them apply. He's proposed a ban on assault weapons. This wasn't an assault weapon. On high-capacity magazines, he wasn't using a high-capacity magazine. The private transaction question, again, goes back to the background check question, which here seems to have failed. So there's nothing in the president's proposals or any of the Democratic gun control proposals that would have prevented him from getting a gun. And if, in fact, he was deemed eligible, then the solutions the Democrats want to help control guns, namely universal background checks, failed in this instance. So complaining that the infrastructure was not in place to prevent a person like this from getting a gun is simply not true.
All right, let's move on to the crazy martini now. And this one comes to us courtesy of the Los Angeles Times. Quote, attorneys for a nationally recognized Los Angeles Unified teacher who was removed from his classroom after allegations of misconduct are issuing an ultimatum to district administrators, publicly apologize and let him return to work or get sued. Rafe Esquith, a longtime educator at Hobart Boulevard Elementary School who has written several books on teaching and received multiple awards for his work, has not been allowed to return to school since district officials launched an investigation in March. His crime, Ian? There was a complaint by another teacher after Esquith read to a class a passage from The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain. The school district essentially put him in what the union calls teacher jail, and they hope to have a resolution to this case by the time school starts again in August. And obviously we've seen this debate go on and on about books that were written in their cultural time and whether or not they're offensive or whatever today. But Huckleberry Finn, obviously a classic in the fact that a nationally recognized teacher is essentially hanging in limbo here because he dared to read a passage of an American classic. Doesn't give you a lot of hope for the education system.
No, indeed not. And it seems like the offending passage here had nothing to do with the racial quote-unquote insensitivity contained in Mark Twain's works, but with a passage that involves an instance of nudity. So we're really lowering the bar a great deal for what counts as offensive or inoffensive in great works of literature, apparently. It's also somewhat disturbing that this was one teacher essentially tattling on another. It doesn't seem to be a great deal of camaraderie or support among the professionals at this particular school. But again, the question is, are you allowed to teach great literature, classic literature, in its fullness, in its depth, without having to censor it, or aren't you? It seems like the more cases like this that we see, we seem to be falling on the side that you're not. You have to sanitize these things. And of course, students who grow each year more and more culturally illiterate are the ones who are the real losers in these situations.
Ian, just as a follow-up before we exit, it seems like this might be another example of the left tying itself up in knots. We talked about the response to the Rachel Dolezal story earlier in the week. Here you've got, you have to assume it's probably upper elementary if they're reading Huck Finn, and that is not okay because of this one passage. Yet in another context, when it comes to sex ed, they want to get this to the kids as soon as humanly possible. So how in the world are those consistent?
Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't thought about that. The key is that they're not intellectually consistent. Of course, that one of the problems with Mark Twain, as I mentioned, is the racial question that's involved in his works and the fact that he was a Southerner. I think it's worthwhile in considering that to also note that Twain was one of the premier observers of the race question in the late 19th and early 20th century in American literature. If you take out his observations based on the fact that he doesn't qualify under our current moral perspective, you really lose a sense of depth and context for the pressing question of race within the American experience. So I think all of that plays into this on a sort of a broader level, but that's a great point, Greg.
Well, that settles it. Mark Twain will never be on the $10 bill. Ian, thanks so much for filling in for Jim. We'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Ian Tuttle of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Have a great weekend, everyone, and tune in again on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.